For whatsoever from one place doth fall, is with the tide unto another brought. For there is nothing lost that may be found if sought. This is Pints with Jack, Season 7, Episode 21, Jack's Bookshelf, Edmund Spencer, After Hours with Father Stephen Gregg. Welcome everyone. Here on Pints with Jack, we're reading our way through the works of C.S. Lewis. This month, we're snooping through Jack's bookshelf, looking at the authors and books which shaped the life and writing of C.S. Lewis. Today's opening quotation about seeking and finding came from Edmund Spencer's The Faerie Queene. And we're glad you sought us out today, and we're very glad that we found today's expert, Father Stephen Gregg. Father Stephen Gregg was born in Texas and entered the Cistercian Order of Our Lady of Dallas in 2006 and made his solemn profession on July 3rd, 2011. On September 8th, 2012, he was ordained to the priesthood. He has taught English, fine arts, Latin and theology at the Cistercian Boys' School, and he is now Affiliate Assistant Professor of English at the University of Dallas, where he completed his doctorate in 2022. Father Stephen Gregg, welcome to Pints with Jack.
Thank you for having me.
Well, greetings from a very chilly Wisconsin at the moment. What is it like in Texas? Unbearably hot?
Compared to Wisconsin, probably hot. Although today is one of those beautiful days where the air is fairly chill, but the sun is very bright and warm. So you can always find a comfortable spot somewhere.
Well, the University of Dallas is actually my wife's alma mater. And so I know it reads me well, and we've gone several times. And when I told her that I was having you on the show, she said, "Oh, I'm a bad wife. I've never taken you to see the Cistercians yet."
You're missing out. We are one of the only, really the only Cistercian monastery of our type in the United States. There's the Trappists, who are more numerous, but it's one of the unique features of the University of Dallas that we happen to have been brought here to start the university, along with various other religious. So you're welcome anytime. We're near the airport, so it's easy to find us.
Yes. Next time I go and visit my sister-in-law and niece, we'll make sure that we hit you guys next time. But on to today. Today, I'm drinking a big coffee because I still have work to do. Are you drinking anything?
I am. I've decided to cancel the rest of the day and just have beer. So this is a beer called Tint Meadow, which is an English Trappist ale brewed by the monks at Mount St. Bernard, which is in Leicester, kind of in the middle of England. So I heard it was good and I bothered to go find some. And it is good.
Wow. I'm impressed and I'm kind of ashamed that I'm not drinking anything more fun, but I suppose this is what happens when you invite a Cistercian onto your podcast. Cheers.
Cheers.
So let's talk about Edmund Spencer. I was very grateful when I got an email from one of our patron supporters the last time we did Jack's Bookshelf. And he told me that he had a Spencer scholar for me to talk to. So, would you mind just laying it out for us? Who was Edmund Spencer? What's his background?
Well, Edmund Spencer, by some measures, is the most important English poet of the Elizabethan era, leaving aside, of course, William Shakespeare, whose works are of a very different kind and influence is universal. So Edmund Spencer was born in London in 1552 or 53, so a little bit older than Shakespeare, and he died relatively young in 1599, so while Elizabeth was still queen, though when he was born, I suppose Mary was queen, things were still rather complicated in England. And his reputation relies mostly on having written a gigantic epic poem, The Faerie Queene, which is some 36,000 lines of poetry, for which he is, for the last 200 years, occasionally been called the poet's poet. He wrote more poetry than most people have ever written, and every English author has read Spencer and reacted positively or negatively. So one of the essential figures. A lot of minute details of his life maybe aren't so important. We don't know altogether very much outside of his birth and later career, but he was, at his death, the first poet, it seems, who was buried in what we call Poet's Corner. I mean, Geoffrey Chaucer was buried there in Westminster Abbey, And Chaucer's grave was there just because of Chaucer's own life and work. Edmund Spenser is the first person buried next to Chaucer as a way of commemorating English poetry. So in a way, it's only when you have two people buried there that it's really a poet's corner, not just Chaucer's corner. So an interesting figure of his own day, and his life in London as a youth, he went to a very good humanist school where he would have learned, we have evidence he knew Latin and Greek very well, along with French and Italian, and so was ready to bring the European Renaissance into English literature, which in many ways is sort of his great position in the history of our literature. He eventually went to Cambridge on scholarship, did very well there at Pembroke College, and got a good post as a kind of mid-level, what would we say, like imperial bureaucrat or something. He was the secretary to a man named Lord Grey, not the Earl Grey after whom the tea is named, but Lord Grey, who, regrettably or not, nowadays mostly regrettably, was responsible for one of the major attempts of the English to take over Ireland. So this is the era of the colonization of Ireland anew by the Elizabethans. So Edmund Spenser left England, moved to Ireland, lived in the south of Ireland, in what we would think of as County Cork, the very south, and lived there for most of his life, working for the Elizabethan overlords of the Irish, while also writing a great deal of very influential poetry. He did go on various campaigns and observed various battles and disasters. Eventually, there was a major uprising in the late 1590s in Ireland, and Edmund Spenser's home and castle were destroyed by Irish rebels, and he fled, apparently barely surviving, with his wife through a secret back door of the house. Rumor is that one of his own infant children died in the escape, managed to get back to London, but died shortly afterwards. So there is this sense that he suffered some immense disaster in Ireland that then left him kind of poor and depressed. One theory is that he had finished all the rest of The Faery Queen. It's only half done, and it's already one of the longest poems in English. And the theory is that maybe it was destroyed in the attack on his castle, and so he was left a bit depressed. But there's no evidence for that. So an interesting life. So shifting between intensely literary life and connected to the great circles of English literature, but really an important political actor, not a nobleman, not one of the leading figures of history, but one of their important assistants and subsidiary figures. Something that, especially given the history of England and Ireland, is very topical still today. Lewis himself being Irish, but Northern Irish, right? Mm-hmm. Not the other kind of Irish, had curious reflections on Spenser's having participated in the kind of oppression of the Irish, but it's a rather complicated picture, actually. So his life, we really don't have a lot of documents, but it's from his writings that he is really remembered, which are numerous.
Now, you mentioned The Faery Queen, and that was what I quoted in the opening to this episode. And I actually first came across this line in the movie adaptation of Sense and Sensibility. Alan Rickman is reading to Kate Winslet at the very end of the movie. And I remember hearing those words. I thought, that's really beautiful. And then I never did anything with it until a few months ago when I knew we were doing an Edmund Spenser episode, and then discovered that's where that came from. So as despite my ignorance, he is an exceptionally important author. But why?
Yeah, exceptionally important, but hardly ever studied at this point. And I don't want to lament on the nature of English education. There's so many things to read, you know, and if you're going to keep one person from the 16th century, you're going to keep Shakespeare for very many good reasons. Mm-hmm. I mean, actually, Lewis is very useful for determining like what might be the importance of Edmund Spenser, because Spenser was in many ways Lewis's focus as a scholar, actually. Although he had many other focuses, Milton, most obviously, but in his big history of English literature, which I think I have here somewhere, the big book, mm-hmm. Spencer is the transition point from there's sort of medieval English literature, which is wonderful and very interesting. There's then the 16th century. The 17th century is all fantastic. That's George Herbert and John Milton and so many figures that are wonderful. The 16th century, Lewis divides into two periods. One is called the drab era. And just, it's not that the literature is bad, but it's not exactly sparkling with wit and intellect and style. And then there's the golden era. And he marks the golden era begins with Spencer and with Philip Sidney, another very important writer who died even younger than Spencer did. So Spencer represents for English literature in a way that Lewis very clearly appreciated the transition from the medieval to the Renaissance, which is always a very delicate moment. And in his analysis, and there's plenty of people who agree with this, there's obviously a more complicated picture. Lewis sees that it's important that in England we preserve some of the Renaissance, some of the medieval era, the style of the Arthurian stories and the medieval moralistic fable. The Renaissance didn't just cancel that earlier past. And so for him, Spencer is the one who manages simultaneously to be a modern Renaissance author, but someone who loves the medieval inheritance. So he'll say that he, in his own life, he denies the breach between ancient and modern, which is something that Lewis and himself is trying to attempt in the much very different but equally chaotic period of the 20th century. So he's the simplest way to put it, though, basically the first poet in English to write something that is on the level of the continental languages. That's how they thought of him in his day. They called him the new poet. We've finally done something that measures up to what's being done in especially France and Italy for the Renaissance. England always a little bit behind the times, which is maybe a good thing in their point of view, a little bit of time to be more reflective. So that is the key place that Spencer holds. There's a more specific sort of importance to him that is one that is very close to Lewis's heart, which is about the nature of romance and chivalry. So Spencer takes a tradition of what we call courtly love. This sort of Lancelot and Guinevere is the classic, or at least the most familiar image to us, where you have a knight who is pursuing this beautiful kind of quasi-divine woman, but that he will never be able to marry her because she's already married to someone else or some other obstacle is in the way. So there's a whole field of literature in the Middle Ages about that. Spencer takes that and redirects it towards an actual kind of married love, domestic beauty. And that's something that Lewis wants to see in Spencer. And a lot of it's there to a degree. He doesn't write about happy marriages very often. You know, it's an adventure story. They're mostly chasing after people and trying to find each other. But there is a sense that love between in a married couple, right? So it's not just the soul and God, nor is it sinful, but this middle ground of two human beings in love with each other is something that Spencer in his poetry begins to give voice to in a way that hadn't really effectively been done, which seems strange to us perhaps, but it's not an easy thing actually to write about. So an interesting figure in the history of the literary tradition in England, but one who, for whatever reason, has sort of vanished from education, even at the undergraduate level. I mean, we at the University of Dallas, the English majors have to read a little bit of Spencer for their comprehensive exams, but it's only in graduate school that they have got to take a whole course on Spencer. So it's only when you're really getting into the foundations of our tradition, especially as Americans, Spencer is very British, very English. so it's even less accessible to us in some way than Shakespeare.
Is that when you encountered him?
That's exactly right. Yeah. I mean, I had heard of Spencer and The Faerie Queen as this sort of gigantic book. famously difficult poem. The plot is meandering to a degree that is unimaginable. But it was, I mean, I started graduate school even kind of late. I was already ordained a priest, and I started my doctoral degree in literature. I was already almost 30 years old. And not that that's so old, but and you know, there weren't a million courses to take. And I knew a professor who was one of my favorites. She had taught a course on 19th century novels, and she was teaching a course on Edmund Spencer. I thought, you know, I think it's time to actually face up to this monumental challenge of this major figure. And I was sort of looking for a dissertation topic, you know, and I ended up choosing Spencer. But it was only by rumor and then in graduate school. And there's something about his work that it is, it's ideal for the graduate student. There's something captivating and sort of infinite about the possibilities. But if you're just a kid, it's on the other extreme, it's excellent for someone who is just reading for fun. But the middle ground where you're kind of half scholarly, that's where it usually gets lost. So it's you can get like children's editions of Spencer with illustrations that are wonderful and very mm-hmm. captivating. Or you can go all in, but it's difficult in between. So. Yeah, I approached it late then, but it found it very captivating.
Yeah, it's funny that you put it like that, because there's quite a well-known Lewis quotation where he says, "Beyond all doubt, it is best to have made one's first acquaintance with Spencer in a very large and preferably illustrated edition of the Faerie Queen on a wet day between the ages of 12 and 16.
Yeah, I love I that's the first quote I gave my students at the beginning of the last semester, even the grad students. There is something about that, right? The large volume with the illustrations and I love that it's a rainy day. Mm-hmm. So you would rather go play outside. But I guess instead I will read a book. And there's something about Spencer that recreates that quality of playing in the rain or playing outside, even though you're actually sitting and reading. And to experience, it's true of so many, I mean, even the Chronicles of Narnia in their way, I mean, you can get the little paperbacks, but there's something about actually having the complete version, this giant book, you know, that is the style that Spencer was aiming for that Lewis seems to have loved and appreciated.
Hmm. What was it about Spencer that first got you hooked?
Hmm. I think for me, very particularly, it was... I wanted to find an author in the 16th century who most closely connected to the classical and medieval traditions of literature. That's what I studied before I joined the monastery. And I didn't want to rush ahead to a modern author and write about Dickens or something. It would have been fun, but I thought I want to see this turning point and watch how a brilliant mind uses his education in all of these new resources to produce something that is profoundly new and strange, while also deeply rooted in his actual culture and even the physical landscape in a lot of ways. So I thought, well, this would be a valuable challenge. And then I just found reading Spencer, he's one of those authors that is hard to quote briefly. Once you start reading, it pulls you in. This part of the poetic technique and form, but also the way that he tells a story that you want to really, it sort of overwhelms you. I encountered that. And like I've done with many other works, but in a way that I thought I should stop and reflect on how this happens, you know? But reading The Faerie Queen, I mean, that's the easy thing. You start reading The Faerie Queen and you think this is... you feel like you're engaging directly with a brilliant imagination that is also very free. Like it's very didactic in some ways, but it's also just like, as Lewis himself would say, like you sort of can turn a corner and you never know what's coming at you. So there's a balance of philosophy and sort of wonder and surprise that is hard to replicate, really.
Hmm. Well, these episodes are really episodes about influence upon Lewis. But what were Spencer's influences? What shaped his mind and writing?
Yeah, it's we wish we had his library. Some authors, we have their whole libraries, you know. But Spencer claimed and most people view it as not quite accurate, that his main influence is, of course, Geoffrey Chaucer, who is the most famous English poet before Spenser, though there are many others. That's 150 years earlier than Spenser. Although he says that, it's not clear that it's really true. It seems like his main influences are two Italian authors, even less well known, but named Boiardo is one. Sounds like Chef Boyardee, but Boiardo, who wrote the Orlando Innamorato, so Orlando in Love. Orlando is there's a famous poem, The Song of Roland, about Charlemagne's sort of great knight Roland, and that's the same character, Orlando. And then Ariosto. These are two of the most important Italian authors of the earlier 16th century, wrote the Orlando Furioso, so Orlando enraged, or that is, he sort of lost his mind because of love, which goes, a poem that goes all kinds of directions, even I think to the moon, if I'm not mistaken. So those are the poems that are most, and these other Italian authors who wrote love sonnets. Petrarch is a major influence in the lyric poetry. It seems like they're the ones that Spenser read when young that he was trying to bring into English. So his main influences. Though, of course, there's also the classical works. So especially the Aeneid of Virgil, which you could do a really good Jack's Bookshelf episode on the Aeneid, by the way. and the philosopher Plato. So Plato is a major influence and Neoplatonic authors in some ways from the Italian Renaissance. So it's hard because Spenser in many ways stands so early in the literary tradition in modern English that, so not Middle English, that we're not familiar with his reading. It's mostly ancient Latin and Greek authors and then contemporary Italian Renaissance writers of epic and lyric poetry. There's debate about the influence of Dante, who also a huge influence on Lewis, of course, right? I think you've already done episodes on Dante. But probably Jason Baxter was here at some point, I bet. But I remember. but we know that Spenser knew Italian because he translates some bits directly into the Faerie Queen, or just translations of other people's works, which is sort of plagiarism. But in the old days, the rules were different. We're not exactly sure the ways that he's responding to Dante's Divine Comedy, but they stand side by side as sort of the huge works of their eras. Dante is 200 years earlier, but this sort of giant allegorical epics that encapsulate an entire society's way of thinking and the set of problems they've got. So there's something there about Dante too. We're just not, exactly certain what's the connection. When did he read what? What is he doing?
Mm-hmm. Well, moving on, could you just give us a sketch of Spenser's corpus? What were his major works? We've mentioned the Faerie Queen a lot. Is it basically that? Is that the one that everybody cares about? Or did he write other things as well?
Yeah, he wrote several other things, but the Faerie Queen is... actually, as Lewis says, like, yes, he wrote many beautiful other things, but he stands or falls based on the Faerie Queen. This is a gigantic poem of a very ambitious scope. So six books, each book has 12 cantos. Each canto is 40 to 60 stanzas long. It's a huge work, published in two parts. So the first three books dedicated to the legend of, the first book is Holiness. The second book is Temperance. The third book is Chastity. So those are published in 1590. Then in 1590, I think it's five, the second set of three, which are from Chastity, we go to Friendship, and then Justice. And then last of all, curiously, is Courtesy. So we go from Holiness to Courtesy. Interesting impulse. So that's the big work. I mean, the other... really two or three or 10 most important. There's a little, his first work is called The Shepherd's Calendar. And it is like January through December for every month. There's a pastoral eclogue, we call it, on the model of Virgil. And that's a very difficult and complicated, strange work, but much studied by those who are into these things. Then he has a sonnet sequence, like Shakespeare does. Shakespeare's lyric poetry, of course, is basically this army of sonnets and then a few long narrative poems. So Spenser has a collection of 80-something sonnets that he wrote. Interestingly, they're addressed to a woman he is about to marry. But it turns out that this is his real second wife. His first wife had died, and he is actually writing sonnets. They're connected to the liturgical seasons, Lent and Easter, in this, in that particular year of 1594, I think. And but he actually marries her at the end of it. So there's sort of engagement sonnets, a very interesting phenomenon and important in the history of lyric poetry. Other than that, he's got a lot of, there's a set of religious, sort of religious hymns called the Four Hymns. There's a lot of poems called complaints, which is to say lamentations on how the world is going to fall to pieces at any minute. Always a popular genre. So, but the Fairy Queen, the Shepherd's Calendar, and the Amoretti, they're called the sonnets. So little, it's like little Cupids, the Amoretti, little flying love baby, you know, floating around. Those are the main things that he wrote. For all we know, there were other things. There's one posthumous work that's very influential, but it's not poetry. So one prose work that lasts is called On a View of the Present State of Ireland. So this is a political dialogue about the trouble in Ireland during his day that is much studied by historians and political theorists, but its connection to the earlier works is something that people are just starting to really put together. So how he did all that while also having a full-time job is not clear.
Yeah. I love the idea of having engagement sonnets. At the time of recording, he hasn't asked her yet, but at the time of publishing, he definitely will have. One of my co-hosts, Matt, is proposing to his girlfriend. At our badgering, we made him write her some poetry a little while ago. And so I think, Matt, that would be a really good addition. While you two are engaged, let's see if we can get out a sonnet or two. I love dropping him in it. Okay, cool. So that's a great overview of his major works. Let's just zoom in a little bit more on the Fairy Queen. You've spoken about its division into books. What is the story about?
Yeah, it's a kind of Arthurian or pseudo-Arthurian romantic adventure story. So each book has a main knight who represents a particular virtue or anyway the quest for that virtue. They're not like saints. They mostly make mistakes, actually, in the story. So from one book to the next, you don't have strict continuity of plot at all, really. I mean, some of the characters will show back up in the next book. And then there's the character of King Arthur, who is in every book, basically, sort of overarches. And then there's the Fairy Queen, who never appears in the book, even though that's the name of the book, who is the woman that King Arthur is pursuing, he says. He had a vision of her and is chasing after her. And she's sort of Queen Elizabeth I. She's sort of also this platonic vision of glory, sort of both. And also she's just the queen of the fairies, something very different. So the Fairy Queen in that way, every book has a main character and you sort of watch his adventures as he aims for some particular goal. The easiest is the first book because it's basically a retelling of the story of St. George and the dragon. So we have a fellow who doesn't know that his name is George. That's a complicated part of the story. He finds out later that he is St. George or will be, but he is accompanying this princess Una, like the number one, basically Una, and trying to go rescue her parents, whose castle is besieged by a dragon. That happens at the end of book one. The rest of book one, however, are weird adventures of the ups and downs of his attempts to help her, often being deceived, wandering away from her, encountering different enemies. He encounters despair, for example, and almost kills himself. And then book two starts and you have an entirely new character named Gawain, which is would be like Sir Gawain, is more familiar, Gawain, mm-hmm. in Arthurian stories, maybe, who has his own mission. And so when you move from one book to the next, it's not at all clear what whether you need to have read the first one in order to understand the second. So there's something else, which is sort of true of the Chronicles of Narnia, weirdly, in its own way, right? You are skipping mm-hmm. through time in Narnia time. So Fairyland is also very hard to pin down. I was trying for my students last semester to outline the plot of the Fairy Queen, and I managed to do book one, and which at that point I gave up. It starts to become... Because often it will be in there's 12 cantos, canto 3 or 4, we leave, the main character walks off stage and we spend half the book following some other set of stories that are related to the main virtue that we're striving for, and they provide excitement and novelty and lots of different layers of meaning, but then the main character shows back up later and, you know, often sort of miraculously ends up in the story. So it's in that way, a very puzzling work. One of the reasons it's difficult to study. Whereas if you read a play by Shakespeare, there's obviously a coherent plot. Otherwise, a play won't work. And the Divine Comedy of Dante has a consistency to itself that is admirable and makes it in many ways easier to study and read. The Fairy Queen, every page, you can't even always tell who's speaking. He doesn't give you the name. He just says, "He said," and it doesn't even really matter who it was. So it's a puzzling little work. But you could think of it either as an Arthurian romance with various knights that he sort of invented and relating sort of English history to Arthurian legend, or it's like a philosophical reflection on certain virtues, which he claims are Aristotelian, though they aren't. I mean, holiness is not one of Aristotle's normal virtues, right? Mm-hmm. Courtesy, not exactly. But that he then gives you sort of emblematic stories. Like if you're going to think about chastity, then here's like 3 or 4 ways that could go wrong. And here's what it's like for it to go right. And so you're being invited to engage with the nature of a virtue through imaginative adventure stories. So a little bit complicated.
Another quotation from Lewis on this. He says, "The poem is a great palace, but the door into it is so low that you must stoop to go in. No prig can be a Spenserian. It is, of course, much more than a fairy tale, but unless we can enjoy it as a fairy tale first of all, we shall not really care for it."
Yeah, I think that is, if you were going to think about the influence of studying Spencer on Lewis, that quote, and there's many others, he makes the same point. Like that is somehow the essential thing, is that you can write a fairy tale that is chaotic, meandering, labyrinthine, that can, nonetheless, by creating a certain atmosphere of character and of landscape, and even just the sound of the poetry, can really guide you towards what's really true and good. You don't have to just write philosophical treatises or didactic fiction. He says you have to enter through the low door, right? So I think actually I was reading the other day, there's a diary entry from Lewis from one of the first times that he met Tolkien, because Tolkien famously is wary of allegory. And like one of the prefaces to The Lord of the Rings, right? Mm-hmm. And of course, they turned out to be very fast friends, but very different characters and mindsets. And he says, Tolkien, he can't read Spencer because of the forms, because Spencer spells everything really weirdly. And he has this strange archaic English, and Tolkien hated it because Tolkien actually knew archaic English. You know, and he wanted to create a realistic seeming languages, and he thought that Spencer was sort of fake. The way that a lot of fantasy literature nowadays, and really after Tolkien, right? Mm-hmm. You have to be a little humble to enter in, but once you enter, is actually a beautiful large space, right? So yeah, that I think is one of the main things that Lewis took away from Spencer, as he didn't write anything like Spencer wrote, but he wanted to try to recreate that effect somehow, that you can write, in Lewis's case, you can sort of write kids literature, children's literature, in a way that is actually very beautiful and spiritually and morally informative, rather than thinking that literature is strictly contrary to that kind of growth, you know?
Mm. When you were describing it earlier in, I mean, not the most encouraging of terms, like slightly meandering and a little bit all over the place, it really put me in mind of Phantastes, which everyone on this podcast should know, made a huge impact on Lewis. And I remember I read Phantastes with my wife, and she knew the backstory to this as well. And at the end of it, it was, what the heck did I just read? But it is also a book that I've enjoyed the more I've gone back to it. And it's not for the plot per se, because much like the Fairy Queen, there are digressions that seem to go nowhere. It's like, all right, I guess we're done with that. We're now moving on to this thing. But it seems to be something about the overall impact of the writing upon the reader. Phantastes with MacDonald had an impact on Lewis that was kind of hard to quantify. And I've seen other quotations from Lewis where he talks about something similar with the Fairy Queen, not only grabbing every reader's imagination, but also he says it's, if it's receptively read, it has psychotherapeutic powers.
Exactly. Yeah. He says, you know, basically to read Spencer is to acquire mental health, you know, so physical and mental health. You just read more Spencer. This is the way that human beings really live and think. Yeah, I do think that for Lewis, at least, and it's a matter of, you know, significant interpretation on his part. I mean, Spencerians today do not by any means agree with all of Lewis's judgments on Spencer as on anything else, but such as academic life. You know, so George MacDonald was so essential in his influence, right? Spencer really is at the beginning of that phenomenon of what we would call fantasy literature, that you can write something that is in this fairyland that is real and serious literature, which MacDonald does. And I mean, yeah, Phantastes, I mean, it's sort of insane as a novel goes, right? I mean, all of it, all of those novels and Cuddy and the Goblin, it's like he's taken sermons he was thinking of giving, right? Those unspoken sermons of George MacDonald and funneling them into like the Grimm Brothers stories or something, right? Which is a real phenomenon of the 19th century, or Andrew Lang's fairy tale books, which were very influential on and were available in the childhoods of Lewis and Tolkien. This idea that those fairy tales might be worth considering seriously, and you could produce versions that were on the level of real literature, as we might say, right? You don't have to just read D.H. Lawrence, right? You could read something else that is equally real, or even more so. One of the influences that Lewis has had on Spencer interpretation, sort of backwards influence, is thinking of Spencer in some ways as one of the first English fantasy writers, someone writing a work that, meandering maybe isn't a compliment, but it sort of is in some ways. Like a good story tends to feel like it's sort of wandering rather than just aiming for a specific purpose.
So that's one large aspect of how Spencer influenced Lewis. Is there anything else that you want to talk about in this area?
Well, too much in some ways, but it'd be fun to think something very specific. So if you read the first book of the Fairy Queen, you come across this character, Una, this beautiful, innocent young woman. And one of her allies in her various trials is a noble lion. Now, anyone who's already read the Chronicles of Narnia, or even just the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, the moment you encounter this, you think, aha, you know, I mean, it's a different story. The lion represents nothing exactly quite like Aslan does. And Una is not Lucy, but you can see how that earlier Chronicles of Narnia sort of prepares me to understand some bigger issue. And then that same character later in book one of the Fairy Queen, when she's unfortunately the poor lion, he enters and then he is slain. So there's none of the story of Aslan coming later. But when she needs help later, she's rescued by a knight named Satyrain. So a satyr sort of raised by fauns. So it's sort of like a heroic version of Mr. Tumnus shows up. Whereas Tumnus is a bit of a goofy kind of a butler or something, you know, you have instead this very vigorous figure. So you see like, well, I see now, and there are many other direct parallels, or even in the last battle, I think it's, what are their names? Shift and Puzzle, the ape and the donkey, mm-hmm. I think. So there's a satire that Spencer wrote for which he actually got in some trouble called Mother Hubbard's Tale. That features also an ape. It's an ape and a fox in this case, but this sort of deceptive monkey figure who is destroying the court of the world. I was reading one article recently that claimed that by reading Spencer, you could understand C.S. Lewis's whole habit of mind. The way that he thinks about anything is rooted in his reading of Spencer. And I suspect more and more that is true. And Spencer is a centerpiece of his history of the English language or English literature in the 16th century. It's the concluding piece of his great scholarly work, The Allegory of Love. Spencer is the last chapter. He was a promoter of Spencer to the frustration of many others on the English faculty at Oxford and Cambridge. But what he found in Spencer is what he called an ordered exuberance. There's something really excessive about Spencer's form of writing. It's exuberant. It's playful. I don't know, the battle at the bridge and Prince Caspian or something. There's these moments, or the end of That Hideous Strength, which is insane, right?
Yes.
there's this exuberance where we're all wearing costumes and it's like a pageant, right? And yet it's ordered. It's an ordered exuberance that deep down there is this hope to aim towards what is true and real and beautiful. I feel that Lewis, I mean, he acquired from many different directions, also his education in philosophy and theology, but he presents Spencer as having manifested this quality of literature that he then seems to have tried to enact. Now, people disagree about his interpretation of Spencer, but that's what he got from it. I think two other very important things so that he gets from Spencer. We already really discussed, which is that a fairy story, a sort of low-level literary form, could actually communicate the most important kinds of whatever lessons literature presents can be presented in lowly forms. And the Gospels themselves, of course, are lowly forms, but also true of fairy tales and children's literature. And then related to that, the value of allegory as a manner of writing. Allegory, not just where one thing stands for another thing, right? Although there is, I mean, Pilgrim's Progress, classic allegory, and then Pilgrim's Regress by Lewis, right? So, he really gets into the allegorical mode of literature. But I think for him, the Fairy Queen is the greatest representation of that, where you can do an allegory at a sustained level in English that really incorporates all these different dimensions of heroic and martial and polite courtly culture, but aims towards something higher and sort of creates a world of interconnected meanings where the fullness of meaning is not evident. It's not scientific meaning, just analyzable and explicable in clear terms, but a mysterious fullness that seems to lurk behind the text. And then that's what he seems to have found in the Fairy Queen, which he then seems to have tried to reproduce significantly in his own writing. One of my favorite little things he wrote, it was posthumous. So he had notes for a series of lectures, but then he died. And so one of his friends, Alistair Fowler, professor, completed is called Spencer's Images of Life. And when I was teaching Spencer last semester to the graduate students, many of whom had read a lot of C.S. Lewis, it was one of the reasons they were in graduate school, basically. he depicts evil, Spencer does, as not as a exciting or dynamic, creative sort of life force, you know, like surging upward, breaking free from restraining impulses, which is sort of this people often associate with Milton's Satan, Lewis himself, and the preface to Paradise Lost in a way, and then William Blake later. And
absolutely,
this idea that, yeah, the evil is this the exciting thing and goodness is basically boring and lifeless and dull. And for Spencer, it's exactly not that way. So evil is sick, depraved, sterile, hollow, right? Like the men without chests. You know, there's one character, he actually is hollow. You stab him and there's no blood comes out. This sort of Nazgul figure that's in Spencer. So this is an idea about the nature of evil as not really a substantial alternative, but a sham that Lewis gets also from Spencer. He gets it from a lot of plays. St. Augustine, he gets it from too, but it's there in Spencer, importantly, and he tries to enunciate. So a lot of other ways in which I feel that Lewis's academic study of Spencer influenced Lewis's own cultural, fictional, and theological writings, although he doesn't always make it super obvious that when you read his views of Spencer, you feel like, but this is his view of all of reality. This is, everything is there somehow. So I think, yeah, a deep influence, which makes it hard to pinpoint the exact moment, you know? Whereas, you know, you can look at The Lord of the Rings by Tolkien and look at the Ring of the Nibelungen, and you can sort of see certain specific things. Mm-hmm. Spencer Lewis seems to have absorbed the way he suggests we need to, like on a rainy day, in a big volume with illustrations. He seems to have absorbed it as a style of thought that he then reproduces in many different realms.
And absorbed many of the same symbols. Mm-hmm. When you were speaking about, for example, the lion and the girl, it's not that they're a simple one-to-one match, but the symbols seem fairly consistent, so that if you've read one and you're introduced to a person in the Chronicles of Narnia, oh, you know about this sort of person, much in the same way that Peter Pevensey, he's when he sees the robin, he instinctively trusts it because all the books that he's read, robins are good characters. It seems like Lewis is importing much of that symbolic backdrop. And I remember him saying of Spencer at one point about how symbols are the natural speech of the soul. And it seems like he just took all of that and incorporated it into his own works.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great, yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, so he thinks that that's what Spencer did. And there's reason, and I think it is in many ways what Spencer is doing. But this idea that by reading the Chronicles of Narnia when I'm young, I might be ready when I'm older to encounter more complex things, but it'll sort of feel familiar, right? Mm-hmm. Like the truth, like the mysterious transcendent truth will seem a little familiar, because when I was a kid, I read something that hinted at this. And Spencer, so Lewis suggested that's what Spencer is also doing. He is providing this sort of an education in his writings that can then help us when we encounter more advanced versions of it, it'll feel a little familiar. It's a really difficult thing to do. And that's sort of what I think Ransom is planning to do when he comes back. You know, he's writing the dictionary. There's a sense that we have to start, I guess what they're thinking is, we got to start planting seeds of real understanding so that when Weston and these others start trying to take over the world, there will be people who are ready to resist somehow. So that's what Lewis wanted to find in Spencer, and it's not inaccurate. I mean, there's a lot of other things going on in Spencer's writings, but
and the point about Ransom there is it's quite illustrative, because Ransom is originally planning to write dictionaries and grammars, but what he does in order to defend Tholkandra is tell a story.
Yeah.
That's how he's going to achieve his change, rather than a more didactive, straightforward approach.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, that was wonderful. We will have lots of links in the show notes, including to, I think it's the article by Susan Wendling. I think that was the one about Lewis's habit of mind that you were referring to, because I also looked at that a little bit earlier. We'll have links to all those sorts of things in the show notes. But I now want to just transition to the last part that we always do in these episodes. And it's like, how do you begin? So if someone has never read Edmund Spenser before, do you recommend they start with The Faerie Queen? And if so, is there a particular translation or edition that you recommend?
Yeah, I think, you have to start with The Faerie Queen. Even though I love, my work is actually mainly with the other poetry that he wrote. but starting with the first book of The Faerie Queen. Now, it's important to come into it realizing that if you buy a copy of The Faerie Queen, you can get, they're rather large, you know, this is the entire Faerie Queen, but each book is separate and separable. You can read just book one. You don't have to look at it as like, I need to read 500 or 700 pages, I think, of three column print. You know, the first book of The Faerie Queen is the place to begin in a lot of ways. It's not the first thing he wrote and it's not the best thing, but it's brilliant. It's this quest for holiness and the figure of Saint George, but the character is actually this sort of bumbling figure, and it moves from his excessive confidence through to his humiliations in different ways, his failures, his rescue by Arthur, and at the end, his combat with the dragon, after a vision of his future destiny. So it's sort of the whole of reality in one book. So that would be the undebatable place to start with Spenser. And Spenser's language is weird. It's mostly spelled very, very oddly. Although it's modern English.
As a dyslexic, it all makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah. So it's perfect for the dyslexic. It's because, and even the U's and the V's are switched, and the I's and the J's, and there's all it works. It's normally, actually, it's hard to find a version that's put in modern spelling. You lose a lot. So I think the thing to do is to face it in just its original form with the confidence that you just have to keep going. You don't have to try to get every little moment. Mm-hmm. The other two, I love books 3 and 4, Friendship, Chastity and Friendship. They kind of go together. You can buy them in one volume from Hackett makes. So there's the big version with the whole Faerie Queen, but then Hackett has individual volumes that are inexpensive and really well made with, they have footnotes for the vocabulary. That's kind of important because there's a few weird words. Actually, there's quite a few weird words. kind of like when you read Shakespeare, right? Like you're going to need a few things defined for you. The other two works, I just feel obliged to recommend. There's a set of things called the Four Hymns. These are hymns to love and beauty. They're not short hymns. They're like 40 stanzas each. But there's one to, it's a hymn in honor of love, which is Cupid, the earthly Cupid, and a hymn in honor of beauty, which is Venus, the mother of Cupid, and then a hymn in honor, or it's just called a hymn of heavenly love, which is a hymn to the incarnate Christ, and then a hymn of heavenly beauty, which is addressed to divine wisdom. So you kind of get Cupid and Venus, and then Christ and wisdom, who is also Christ, really, but in a very strange form there. So they are really captivating, especially for the Christian reader. Mm-hmm. And his sonnets are very good. But I think Faerie Queen Book 1 is the place to go most clearly.
Well, as we wrap up, is there a favorite passage you have from the Faerie Queen Book 1 that you might like to read to us?
Oh, gosh. Yeah. So many. I'll have to pick. Each book of the Faerie Queen starts with a proem, a few stanzas, a kind of prologue, but might be good just to read the very first one. So this is just one stanza,
Okay. The
beginning of the first book, before you get into book one of it, where the poet is introducing himself. Mm-hmm. And this is what he says. Lo, I the man whose muse, Whilom did mask as time her taught in lowly shepherd's weeds, and now enforced a far unfitter task, for trumpet stern to charge mine oaten reeds, and sing of knights and ladies' gentle deeds, whose praises, having slept in silence long, me all too mean, the sacred muse areads to blazon broad amongst her learned throng. Fierce wars and faithful loves shall moralize my song. It's a cool opening. The praises of love have lain quiet, so I need to combine the life of warfare, martial praise, with the life Mars and Venus being reunited somehow in the poem, is what he is trying to do. To combine the realm of effort and striving with love and contemplation. They're hard things to balance together. So it's a good introduction to the whole work.
Father Stephen Gregg, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Can you please tell us where people can go to find out more about you, your order, the Fairy Queen, whatever you'd like to advertise?
Yes, well, I mean, the best thing to find out about is the Cistercian Order, to which I owe virtually all of the things I have and know about life. So we're here in Dallas. You could always come visit, but we do have a good website for our school and also for our monastery, which is www.cistercian.org. You do have to know how to spell Cistercian, but there's only one website, cistercian.org. And that is, in many ways, the place to go to read about our community, the monks who are here, the monks who founded our monastery, who were refugees from Hungary when the Soviets closed our mother house in 1950, and the strange adventures that they have had, and then our work at our school and at our university. For the Fairy Queen, there are many resources. You can find the whole text online. There's a kind of antiquated but still very good website called Luminarium, L-U-M-I-N-A-R-I-U-M, Luminarium, which has good copies of all great medieval Renaissance English authors, and they have the whole Fairy Queen on there along with other articles and such. There is also a good audiobook of the Fairy Queen. I think the narrator is named Timon. His last name is Timon, but that you can find through Naxos, which produces a lot of audiobooks, and you can get through public libraries and so on, so that some people find it easier to understand with a good reader and sort of read along.
Is that David Timpson?
That might be, yeah, something like that.
Wonderful. Well, I'll have links to that in the show notes as well. As I hear the call for final drinks, I'd like to thank our guest again, Father Stephen Gregg, our sound engineers, Taylor and Sarah, our intern, Julia, all of the listeners and all of our patron supporters, particularly our top tier supporters, Mary Margaret, Aldo, Alex, James, Matt, Erica, Joel, Amanda, Thomas, Bud 1, Bud 2, Shane, Kay, Paul, Gary, Stephen, Kelly, Chris, John, James, Kate, Peter, David, Angela, and Rowdy. We pray for you all every week and whenever there's an episode being released. And thank you to Gregory Graham, who's the person who introduced me to Father Stephen. If you've enjoyed this episode, please share it on social media and maybe give the Fairy Queen a go. And please join us next time when we'll continue going further up
and further in.
Cheers!
Cheers!